Hello and welcome to Inside Politics from the Irish Times. This is Pat Leahy sitting in for Hugh Linehan this week. Well, it's the morning after the budget day before. How was it for you? Are you a young person looking forward to cruising around on half-price public transport, perhaps in search of opportunities to use your free contraception? Are you a pensioner flush with an extra fiver a week? Will your fuel bills be monstered by carbon tax increases? Will it make your childcare a bit easier? And what of the political effects of this budget, as the coalition seeks to plot out the future where politics meets economics after COVID? So, Cliff, if I can start with you, you're basically suggesting, I think if I read it correctly in your analysis piece this morning, that Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue basically hoodwinked their colleagues into this budget by not revealing to them the full extent of the economic surge and consequent tax receipts that they've enjoyed in recent months. Is that a fair summary?
Very strong words, Pat, very strong words. Yeah, I mean, I think it's been interesting over the last few months when you look back at it now and look at the way that it's panned out. So we had the summer economic statement, which was done on the basis of pretty conservative economic forecasts, given the kind of evidence that things were actually starting to pick up and spending ceilings were set for next year. And indeed, the Fiscal Council was critical of the summer statement on the basis that it might be going too far in terms of spending in the next few years and not outlining how it was going to be paid for. Then you roll on a few months just before the budget, about 10 days, the economic forecasts were increased, and the two ministers were still playing the line with, look, we have to stick within the limits. The Fiscal Council have told us we have to be cautious. Don't know what's going to happen next year and all that. And then the weekend before the budget, we finally get the white paper, which gives the kind of financial forecast on how the finances are going to improve on the basis of these improved economic forecasts. And the numbers were just extraordinary. They published this thing kind of at about half nine or quarter to 10 at night. So I was here last Friday night kind of reading the numbers and reading them again and saying, have I misunderstood something here?
I recall getting a rather excited text message from you late at night on this subject.
I know. Sad indeed, you're right. But anyway, it was a remarkable change because borrowing was due to be 20 billion this year, over 20 billion. And the forecasts have been cut to 13, just over 13 billion. And that's a really significant change in a few months. Normally you might see maybe a billion one way or the other. And most of it was due to buoyancy and tax revenue. There were some spending issues as well, and spending coming in less than expected, although still increasing very strongly. And then looking at next year, even after the budget, we had thought, or at least the summer economic statement had speculated that borrowing next year might be over 14 billion on the basis of the way the economy is going. And now it turns out it's going to be just a bit over 8 billion, 8.2 billion. So these are really, really significant changes. And I suppose allowed the ministers to come forward with a reasonably generous package, even though everyone is saying, you know, it's not enough, I want more and all that, while at the same time bringing down borrowing. I think there's no doubt that if the other cabinet ministers had known 6 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, that this was going to happen, that there would have been a lot of calls for more. But the reality of it was kept under wraps late enough, I think, that they got away with it.
I think, on the basis of some inquiries made on the subject in recent days, that there was quite a push from some of the spending ministers and possibly even from the centre of government in the last week to expand that 4.7 billion package. But the two budget ministers, Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue, basically fought that off, which I think, Jack, tells us something about how this government operates internally and maybe about the strength of that McGrath-Donoghue axis within government.
Yeah, I think it might also tell us something about the good political instincts of Norma Foley, who seems to have been the last minister to sign off her budgetary allocation late on Sunday evening and managed to get record allocations to the special needs sector. Perhaps she sensed in the waters that, you know, there was some more money sloshing around, and if she held out, she might get a greater allocation. But to the broader point, I think that's true. I think that, you know, the McGrath-Donoghue axis, I remember at budget time last year someone unkindly remarked to me that it was the only functional part of a vastly dysfunctional government. I don't know if that's still true, but it's still certainly true that it's the strongest part of this government. And I think that the reasons for that are pretty clear and obvious. They reach back to the confidence and supply era when McGrath was, you know, he was actually deeply involved in the budgetary process and budget making. And if he didn't have veto power on some things, he certainly had significant power over saying which measures went ahead or not. And that the strength of that relationship has carried over into the government and has been also forged and strengthened again by the fact that even though we've had two budgets under this government, we've had such an extraordinary level of fiscal interference and economic support that, like, if you throw in July jobs last year, which was, I think, a 7 billion plus package, and then the kind of two forays into the economy that went hand in hand with the two big lockdowns, that's March of 2020 and December, January of 2020, 2021, there's actually been a huge amount of action through those departments, a huge amount of money flowing out through those departments and into the real economy, supporting the demand side of the economy as the public health restrictions really bit. So I don't think it should be any surprise that, you know, this relationship, and I think it's to the favour of government that this relationship, the most important bilateral ministerial relationship, remains strong and seems to have been strong enough to hold the line against those inquiries that would have come across both from the centre government and from line ministers over the last couple of days.
Seamus, just on the related topic, if a 4.7 billion budget was appropriate, as the two ministers maintain it to be, when they set their summer economic statement and thus setting the budget parameters at a time when borrowing was expected to be much, much higher and the economic turnaround that Cliff described earlier had not yet really occurred or manifested itself in the tax figures, how is the same budget appropriate now? If it is, tell us if you think it isn't, of course.
Like, I think in Ireland, we're finding it difficult to wean ourselves off the old McCreevy line of when I have it, I spend it, and basing budgetary forecasts on changes in numbers that happen over a short period isn't how our budgetary policy should be set. When it comes to the size of this budget, I think whether it was a 4.7 billion budget remains to be seen. Although it was budget 2022, there was a significant number of spending increases for 2021 that were also announced, and they could have been built into the base. So maybe there was more than the 4.7 billion. But the process of setting the parameters for the budget has to move away from that short-termism. And what the Department of Finance and the Minister for Finance and the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform are now saying is that the size of the budget is based on the medium-term growth potential of the economy. So what is sustainable over the medium term, not what comes in on a short day-to-day basis. So, for example, in a couple of years' time, we could, for example, see a shock in corporation tax in this late-night, Friday-night paper that comes out before the budget. Does that mean that we should slash the amount that's available in resources in the budget a couple of days later? No, we shouldn't have based our spending in the first place on maybe such temporary revenues. So I think a more medium-term view, and it must be remembered that the bounce back in the economy now is indeed temporary. We're comparing it to 2020 and 2021 when large parts of the economy were shut. The growth that's happening now is just getting back to where we were before. Perhaps when we were comparing and looking at the economy, it should be done in terms of levels. How close are we to where we were in 2019? And if you look over that period, like, government spending has risen pretty rapidly over that period. In 2019, excluding interest payments, government spending was just over 80 billion. Next year, it'll be in the mid-90s if you strip out the COVID and strip out the interest. So it'll have gone from 80 billion plus in 2019 to 95 billion or close to it in 2022. And that is a pretty rapid rise. But it is actually maybe in line with the medium term and potential growth of the economy. So I think if we can move away from the when I have it, I spend it mentality, and I understand why government ministers can see figures improving, and there's no doubt there was a significant improvement in income tax, corporation tax, and a significant drop in spending elsewhere. But I think the approach of looking over the medium term is the right one, but whether the political system can hold to it remains to be seen.
Do you think there's something kind of fundamentally flawed about the process of ministers bidding? I mean, Jack referred to earlier about Norma Foley holding on until late and thus getting the benefit of maybe a bit of looseness that might have been there at the end, or some unallocated resources that might have been there at the end. I mean, I've spoken to ministers many times who've been involved in the budget process, and the dilemma for them is always when to settle, when to strike a deal with finance and public expenditure. Do you do it early and get as, you know, as big a chunk as you possibly think you can at that stage? Or do you hold out? You know, do you play the game a little bit longer in the knowledge that everybody has to settle at some stage? And if you go right down to the wire, maybe you can squeeze a few extra quid out of them. But that sort of antagonistic process whereby, you know, ministers are always looking for extra resources for their department without really any thought given to how that impacts on, you know, central government figures. Do you think there's something flawed about that?
Yeah, I think it further exacerbates this sort of short-termism, this going from year to year. Like in Ireland, we do have ministerial expenditure ceilings, which are supposed to be set over a three-year period. But of course, they're revised every year. So you do get this sort of bidding and bargaining and looking for what's happening. Whereas in other countries, they tend to have a more medium-term budgetary framework. Coalition governments at the start set out what they're going to do over a 3, 4, or 5 year period. And they say, look, in year two, we'll do this. In year three, we'll do this when the resources are available. And there tends to be not quite a long-term view, but at least more medium term rather than going year to year. Like in Ireland, we don't tend to have those medium term plans. We don't know what the changes will be even 2 or 3 years down the line. But and maybe if ministers knew what their budget would be, it actually would be in 2 or 3 years, they could make plans and they say, look, we're focusing on this year, the extra resources next year will go on this. But we have this short term, this bit of a game, this competition, who's holding out a bit longer. It kind of contributes to a small sense of instability, not hugely. I think there are other factors that lead to our instability, but it does sort of limit the ability to do medium-term planning.
It's worth pointing out as well, though, that while this is perhaps an injurious thing that we have to put up with in terms of budgetary policymaking, I think the political system quite likes this. Like, it's quite good for ministers to be able to, you know, sally forth into the budget negotiations with a kind of modish or fashionable policy goal in mind and emerge from them holding that aloft and saying, look, I delivered on the topical thing. I delivered on the thing that the media and my constituents are most worried about at the moment. So it's one of those things where perhaps the competing priorities between, you know, like sober policymaking and political realities come into sharp relief.
Is there a reality behind that, or is it kind of theatre? You know, I was wondering when I heard the Norma Foley stuff, you know, was there a bit of a minister kind of saying she's putting up a great fight and then declaring a great victory afterwards? Or is there a reality behind that? Is everything kind of sorted 2 weeks before the budget, really?
Reality or theatre? This thought did cross my mind when I was writing the lead on Sunday, but mostly I was just glad to have something to put in the lead slot. So
I think we should acknowledge that it may not just be the politicians who are addicted to the budget circus. I think there may be some extent to which the media partakes fully in the spectacle. But what I was going to ask you is that if this budget is, you know, is built against a background of this extraordinary economic surge, how long is that surge likely to continue? Is it something that blows itself out over a couple of months, or is it something that lasts a bit longer and therefore contributes to one of the kind of problems in the background for this budget, which is the spectre of inflation?
Yeah, it's a hard one to call. And as Seamus said, you know, a lot of it is obviously a bounce back from last year when you look at the figures, because half the economy was closed for a large part of last year. I think it'll continue into next year. I think there is some reality to it, and the multinational sectors seem to be still doing very well. I was talking to people in a range of sectors for a piece I did for last weekend, and really struck by the level of busyness they're reporting. Everyone in professional services, everyone in restaurants, pretty much across the economy, everyone's saying flying busy. Their main problem is finding staff. The main problem is paying for staff. So I think it'll run into next year and maybe to the middle of next year. Beyond that, really, it's kind of a question of who knows. There's a lot of uncertainty, not only about the Irish economy, but about the world economy's exit from the pandemic. You know, we're not used to seeing this. We've no idea really how this is likely to work out. But you're right, the inflation question and the whole clogging up of supply chains, labour shortages, all those kind of things have been put down as temporary factors, but we really don't know whether they will be or not. And I think listening to central bankers over the last while, there was a lot of confidence over the summer that this was short term, and now there's a degree of kind of caution being baked into comments. So it's very hard to see where things are going to be in the middle of next year, where the interest rate outlook is going to be in the middle of the next year. I think the economy will enter 2022 moving very strongly, but after that, I'm not sure really. And obviously, that's going to frame a lot of things. I mean, if you take the argument that growth is going to remain strong in the economy and we're not going to see a big fall off in corporation tax, then it does give, a better platform to kind of look at funding the things that we now look like we're going to plan to do over the next few years, a bigger state that everyone has spoken about, more spending on health, kind of a permanently higher level of government spending and therefore a permanently higher level of tax. And I think Pascal Donoghue has kind of done this as a process. So there was no way that was going to happen this year, and no way any taxes were going to go up this year. But you might note that he has asked the Commission on Tax and Welfare to report next summer, which is going to look at all these issues. And I understand the discussions around that table are already fairly robust. So this is going to start coming into focus, if you like, in next year's budget. Okay, we're looking at all these greater social entitlements. We're looking at better sick pay. We're looking at higher spending. How are we going to pay for it? How is this going to be funded? How's the whole thing about the aging population and the green agenda going to be paid for? There's a lot to play for, I think.
And Seamus, just on that point of the bigger stage, you've referenced to 2019 earlier on. Of course, you know, one of the biggest differences between now and then is that there is, you know, it seems a political commitment to a bigger state with a greater level of social provision, not least in housing, but also in other areas. And is that bigger state, can that be paid for by growth, which is what people in government tend to say, or, as Cliff has suggested, are there going to be more difficult decisions on rising taxes inevitable to pay for that bigger state in the future?
No, I don't think growth on its own can pay for a bigger state, because if we have more economic growth, you will be looking to maintain people's living standards. You can't have the economy growing and then saying we're not going to increase public sector pay in line with private sector wages, or we're not going to increase social welfare payments in line with wages or other incomes in the economy. So growth on its own isn't going to pay for a bigger state. You want to be having everybody having the higher living standards that growth should bring. If you want to increase the size of the state as a share of the economy, you're going to have to pay for it somehow. So temporarily, at least, you could pay for it by borrowing. But as we've seen in this crisis, the importance of a government having borrowing capacity when it needs it. We saw in 2008 what happens when a government doesn't have borrowing capacity when it needs it and the problems that emerge. So we've seen that you can borrow money, and borrowing is right for governments to do, but only in certain occasions. If we are to have a higher state, it should come from sustainable revenue sources. It shouldn't be something that rises and falls with things like corporation tax or economic growth, etc. It should be put on a stable footing. Now, can we do that in Ireland? I'm not necessarily sure. We have plenty of people who do argue for more government provision of services and supports, but then trying to find the resources to provide it, to actually pay for that. We can always say, don't tax me, don't tax D, tax the fella behind that tree. And you have, whether it's the US multinationals or high income individuals, but whether putting our vital public services on a basis of revenue sources that mightn't be sustainable isn't different. European countries, other European countries do it, but they do tend to raise much higher levels of tax right up and down the income distribution. Like the big difference between Ireland's income tax raising and other European countries is the relatively low amounts we collect at the lower end of the income distribution. Towards the middle of the income distribution, we're close to average. And once you get towards the top of the income distribution, we're actually not far from the average. So whether we want to change it, like a progressive income tax system brings benefits. It reduces inequality. It facilitates more disposable income at the lower end of the income distribution. But it does then come for a cost in terms of the overall amount of tax revenue collect. And it's no easy choice. If we want a larger state, these are just all the issues you must face up to. Do you want to increase income tax at the lower end of the distribution? It's not palatable, but where additionally can you get the resources for the larger state it seems that we now want?
Jack Sinn Féin would say you get those resources from, you know, from people, from higher earners and from businesses. And there seems to be certainly a broad public willingness to consider that at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that, I mean, you know, Seamus is talking about the political unpalatability of trying to raise more taxes from the lower end of the income distribution. I mean, just think of how inimical that would be and how politically explosive that would be in the current environment, whereby you have an opposition that is effectively pushing the viewpoint that, you know, the mainstream government governs for insiders, and that narrative is landing, it seems, with voters at the moment. Imagine if the government was to say, look, we need to raise more tax, we're going to raise it from the lower end of the income distribution. It would be utterly politically toxic and folly, and it would harden that division, harden that sense. But I think that the idea that there is somebody else to tax more heavily is one that has political currency at the moment, be it higher earners, US multinationals, whatever. And you saw that in the recent debate over PRSI when the advisory papers came out before the budget, and it recommended effectively raising PRSI across the board. And Sinn Féin said, no, we're only going to raise it on the employer's end of it. So that sense that there is somebody else to tax and they're not being taxed as a result of a political choice that is inbuilt into the kind of the Irish political mainstream's mainframe approach, that is something that is salient. It's landing with voters. We see that opening up a gap in our most recent polling of 10 points between Fine Gael and Sinn Féin. So I don't think that we should expect those kind of threads, those narratives within the political discourse to go anywhere anytime soon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to talk more about the politics of it shortly, but Seamus, before we go to a break, I just want to ask you, your former chief knob on the Fiscal Advisory Council. Fiscal Advisory Council, not under your stewardship, has been quite critical of the government in recent months, but last night gave, it seemed to me, maybe two cheers for this budget. What did you see that? What was your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so I think early on in the summer, I think the Fiscal Council were sort of critical of the way the figures were presented by the government. They had the Stability Programme update, which really was a very mechanical and technical exercise and offered little insight into what was going to happen over the coming years. And then we had the Summer Economic Statement, which actually was a bit better. There was a big change in the figures, the size of the debt and the deficits over the future, but they actually were more realistically based on what was going to happen. So I think the criticism early in the year was about the unrealistic nature of the figures, and then the summary economic statement was a bit better. And we had this move to the more medium-term plan that government budgetary package sizes would be based on the potential growth of the economy. And I think the Fiscal Council were, in a sense, supporting this more medium-term view, and some of the initial comments from them this time around seem to be in support. I think they will go through the detail of the figures to see how closely the ministers actually have held to the position they said they were going to take. So we've heard frequent references to that $4.7 billion package. As I said earlier, I think once we look at some of the changes for 2021 and if they were built into the base for 2022, maybe the announcement yesterday actually were slightly better. So I think if I was looking at it with a Fiscal Council hat on, you would be relatively pleased with the change in approach being taken, hopefully putting things on a more sustainable footing. If they got close to it on this occasion, again, you'd be, as you say yourself, maybe going for those two cheers for what's happened. But I think once they dig into the detail, and it'll take a couple of weeks for them to dig into the detail and publish their full report, maybe towards the middle of November, there probably will be praise for the approach taken, But I'd hold fire yet on whether the figures actually are reflective of what was announced yesterday.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, I want to ask Jack about the political reaction in Leinster House. And you're very welcome back. Jack, you were, along with the rest of us, were once more prowling the corridors of Leinster House, wailing backbenchers and ministers alike yesterday. My sense is that there was a certain sort of kind of brittle nervousness on the government side about the budget. No one was finding specific fault with it, but they were worrying that the largesse was spread perhaps too thinly to achieve any sort of a political bounce. What was your sense of it?
There's always a kind of intake of breath after the budget. You know, there's a moment where all the hacks and the opposition are combing through it and parsing what's in there and trying to find either, you know, a massive unexploded landmine that the government has stepped on or failed to diagnose as a political risk, or just trying to identify a theme, you know, like this is the budget for carers, or this is the budget that leaves out, you know, take any interest group. And there's a kind of moment where people are waiting to see, does something attach? Does something land in that space? And that moment went on for quite a long time yesterday. And I would argue still that nothing major has emerged in that space to define this budget. So I think that you're right, that the biggest political risk, such as there is one, is the sense that, you know, this does a little bit for a lot of people and therefore doesn't feel like it does very much for anyone at all. And you know, it might just be a bit of a damp squib budget. And I think that that's probably no bad thing from the perspective of the financial and economic ministries, who probably would quite like stability at this stage, above all other things. In terms of risks of blowback on specific things, renters, I think, you know, there's an absence of a particular intervention in favour of renters there. There's a limit on the free contraception programme, age 25.
Sure, who would need it after 25?
Exactly, yeah. There are those other things that you know, might present short-term political obstacles. I think perhaps maybe one that's more medium-term is they've made a big bang announcement on childcare, but it's all going to be focused on freezing fees in exchange for improving T's and C's for workers in the sector, which is obviously laudable. People in the sector need a hand, but it's not going to make, you know, the point of access cheaper for parents anytime soon. So I think that parents will be looking around and saying, well, you know, I'm still paying another mortgage or whatever in childcare. But to bring it full circle, you know, I think when you're talking to backbenchers in particular, and perhaps even backbenchers who may be known to be on the grumpier end of the spectrum, and they're saying, you know, pleasantly surprised, much ado about nothing. You know, Willie O'Dea was looking for €10 in the pension, which was never on the table. He's obviously naturally a little bit disappointed that it doesn't come through, but there's no massive blowback from the backbenches, and I don't think any of the attack lines necessarily from the opposition are landing. So I think it's a budget that will move through the political system fairly quickly without making much of an impact.
Cliff, one of the functions of a budget in political terms is like a sort of a klaxon for the government to broadcast a message on a day that people are actually tuned into what politicians say, which is not always the case for most people. We should constantly remind ourselves. So, you know, if this budget is a political klaxon, what is its message?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I was thinking of that watching Primetime last night, where one contributor after the next was coming on and saying, you know, not enough, disappointed, you know, feel we haven't been heard, you know, even to the extent of business people who have maybe got a lot of money out of wage subsidies and various other helps over the last year or so. And of course they needed it, and it was, you know, every right to argue their corner. But it seems that eaten bread politically has been completely forgotten, and everything has moved on. And it's kind of like we've kind of come out, hopefully, of the pandemic, or the worst of it anyway. And it was almost like kind of we're in a holding pattern in that budget. There wasn't kind of a clear message or a clear direction, you know, in terms of policy. I suppose a lot of it was a lot of the political fire had been shot when the National Development Plan was published a couple of weeks ago. And there was all this talk about, you know, the major investments that were coming up over the next few years. And that is clearly going to be a theme of the government. And that, I suppose that was followed up in the budget by talk of improvements in areas like childcare in particular that Jack has been speaking about. But I suppose 2 points come to mind. One is that from the point of view of this coalition, if you're hanging your hat on those kind of issues rather than, you know, giving people money via tax reductions or direct welfare payments, then you have to deliver. So if they're saying that they're going to improve the provision of childcare, and they're going to, you know, stabilise it first and then look at making it cheaper, there has to be kind of a strategy and a delivery to do that if they're going to kind of win back that territory that, you know, from the opposition, and the same in housing as well. The second thing that struck me looking at it was that I think there's, if the figures do remain reasonably strong over the next few years, and as Seamus said, you know, who knows what's going to happen with corporation tax? We just haven't a clue, really. But if they do, there is going to be a big argument about the level of borrowing and what's appropriate. I think with Sinn Féin taking the tack that we should, with low interest rates remaining low, be prepared to borrow a good deal more. The government has now said it's going to balance its books in a couple of years' time, quicker than anticipated, only going to borrow for capital purposes from next year on. So if that trend does continue, there is going to be, I think, a big debate about how we should manage the public finances in the next few years, and particularly how and where we should invest. I think that's going to be one of the key points of the next election.
Seamus, there's a certain element of this budget in common, it seems to me, with all economic planning, which is, you know, things will be grand as long as things over which we have no control work out in the future, and all our plans are kind of contingent on that. Cliff has touched on a couple of them there, but what do you see as the main external risks facing the country over the coming years, and how might they impact on budgetary issues?
Yeah, I suppose there's a couple of things that could happen externally. I suppose the global economy is something we're readily dependent on, given the amount of trading we do, and if the global economy performs well, that will lead to improved economic conditions in Ireland. In terms of policy risks you could face, of course, we face the risks in relation to interest rates. At present and for the last decade, they've been at historic lows. There are murmurings of interest rate rises, but at present they remain no more than that. I think it's unlikely that central banks would be in a rush to increase interest rates, and they will wait to see how the current sort of inflation at the moment spike plays out. If it becomes more than spike and is a level shift in inflation, then they might look at interest rates. But I think some of the inflation is, again, referring to the bounce back in the economy. Price of energy was much lower last year when large parts of global economies were shut. So let's see how much of that inflation is permanent. And if there is a rise in interest rates, that does present issues, particularly maybe on the government side, just because of the size of the debt we now have, which is estimated to be $240 billion by the end of the year. Yes, the NTMA have locked in the low interest rates for a considerable period. But if interest rates are higher, when that money rolls around again to be reborrowed, that could lead to issues with the public finances. Like, the size of the debt itself isn't a huge concern. I know yesterday the minister referred to €50,000 for every man, woman and child in the country, but we're not going to repay that. That's the debt we've built up over the last 100 years.
I'm not going to repay my 50 grand anyway.
through various crises, like with maybe the first big surge in the 1980s when it got to close on, in euro terms at least, 50 billion. By the time we got to 2008, it was still 50 billion. And then we added 150 billion in quick, short time, and it reached 200 billion, which is roughly where it was before this crisis. And it's now reached 240 billion. So we go through these periods where significant borrowing is undertaken, but we're not going to repay it. But what we are going to have to pay is the interest. And that's why the interest rates are worth keeping an eye on. At the moment, they're not a concern, but they could be higher in the future. Of course, then the other thing that could impact us globally is how multinational companies are taxed. We have seen some changes, and maybe in and of themselves, those changes aren't hugely significant. But the agreement reached last week has set principles that could potentially have more significant consequences down the line. We now have in place a global minimum tax for the taxation of multinational companies. That is currently at a rate of 15%. Who's to say it will continue to remain there? And we have a change in that companies now will pay at least some of their tax where they have their customers. We are a small country that make lots of things and do huge amounts of exporting. We don't have the customers. If the tax is paid where the customers are, we are going to lose. And again, the initial change there won't be that significant. It possibly will lead to some losses in Ireland. But if over time you get sort of mission creep and more tax goes to the big countries. Well, that would be a concern for us. So those are, like, there's the performance of the overall global economy on which we're dependent. That's what happens with interest rates and corporation tax. And I view those as being things essentially which we have no control over, but we should be keeping an eye on them.
To which triangular squeeze, making it, I suppose, a quadrangular squeeze, you might add, you know, the danger of inflation as well. And Jack, if, you know, if we find our ghoulies in this quadrangular squeeze over the coming years, what effect does that have on politics? If, say, a government, if future governments are unable to do a 4.7 billion or 5 billion or even 4 billion giveaway budget, does this government have the kind of strength and coherence and resilience to deliver, you know, a neutral budget or something, you know, a lot less givey away than they've done this year? Because I have my doubts. I don't know what you think.
We should dwell for a moment on the image of our ghoulies being in a quadrangle squeeze before moving on.
I mean, our metaphorical national ghoulies. I mean,
I think that the resilience of this government, such as it is, I'm not sure is necessarily built on this idea that, you know, it delivers massive benefits through the budgetary cycle or through any other cycle, which noticeably improve the lives of citizens. So I'm not sure that it would be like a fatal blow or anything if their budgetary room for manoeuvre was reduced in the years ahead. I think that one of the core messages of this government is broadly speaking kind of competence and confidence in its reliability, you know, that they can, that the mainstream can still manage the economy and the political system and do so competently. I think that, you know, there are risks to them being able to deliver on that, though, which aren't necessarily located just strictly within the budget day itself or whatever size a budget package may be. And I think that they have correctly identified those two risks in the forward-looking material that they publish, as one being related to inflation and two being related to, you know, an upsurge in COVID. I think they've, just to take the second one first, I think they've probably made a reasonable sized allocation. There's about 4 billion in the COVID reserve fund. There's about 2.8 billion in COVID funding up front, and they have 500 million in European funding that is also part of the reserve fuel tank. So if we do have to go into some period of public health restrictions, I think that, you know, broadly speaking, would be okay. I think that the real challenge that would present, if it were to materialize, would be how it would intersect with that other second risk, the inflationary risk, because we've now got this dynamic in the economy where when we go into lockdown, we build up savings and then kind of spend them quite quickly as we come out. So if we were to, let's say, go into some form of a lockdown over Christmas and winter, and then come out of that next spring, and there's a bunch of savings dumped into economy that has all these kind of secular trends around inflation, that just presents a big economic wobble for them to negotiate. And their capacity to do so will be the litmus test for the government. And whether that locates itself neatly within budget day, I'm not sure, but it is a big challenge.
Finally, Cliff, Charlie Haughey once described what he imagined to be the writers of Irish Times editorials as elderly Protestant ladies sitting in a bath as the water went cold and lapped around her nether regions. Now, I happen to know that not all of that is true, but this morning's Irish Times editorial describes this budget as being all about spending. If that is so, and it's certainly true that, you know, there was nine parts spending increases to one part tax reduction in yesterday's 4.7 billion. Does that make it a social democratic budget?
Yeah, I mean, the whole axis of politics, I mean, you're the expert of this, but it's moved leftward, hasn't it? There's no constituency in Leinster House now, or it seems in the wider population for you know, a smaller state and lower taxes. Indeed, I saw Michael McDougall writing this morning that maybe it's time for the PDs to come back, but I'm not sure. You could argue what level of support they might get. I just don't know. But certainly the demands, the trends, the, you know, the post budget. analysis was all on whether enough has been spent in various areas and very little on tax. And even if you look at the tax reductions in inverted commas that were done, they were really just, in the case of many taxpayers, ensuring that if they got wage increases, and a lot of people will get wage increases, that the tax authorities aren't going to take a little bit more in their incomes. This has been, I suppose, a trick that Irish finance ministers have used since the last crisis, is that the tax bans and credits haven't been adjusted, and tax has just crept up year after year to be, a very large contribution to the exchequer. So, I think you're right. Even, I suppose, Leo Varadkar, who has been made his name calling for tax cuts, or appeared to stand for that that policy approach, has seemed to change approach in the last 6 months or so, and been calling for spending right, left and centre. A big issue for this government now is building up social entitlements. I think that's a big issue they're going to play on over the next year. And this will be an interesting bit, try and change the narrative so that people will accept paying a bit more in on the basis that they will get a bit more out in future. It strikes me in the current political kind of environment, that's going to be difficult. But I think if they are going to move towards where they want to move towards, that's the kind of argument they're going to need to make.
Well, all we can say is good luck with that. And with that, our time is up. My thanks to Seamus Coffey, to Jack Horgan-Jones, and to our resident old Protestant lady, Cliff Taylor. Thanks also to producer Declan Conlon and to JJ Vernon on sound. We'll talk to you next week.
The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.